Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Harvey Guillen, an actor you may have seen on shows like Documentary Now, The Good Place, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and Apple's Little America. He also played Benedict Pickwick on The Magicians, and these days he's the not-so-secret weapon of FX's TV series What We Do in the Shadows, playing Guillermo, the human familiar to Kevin Novak's Nandor the Relentless. The show returns for its second season with back-to-back episodes this Wednesday at 9 p.m. I've seen them, they're great, and Harvey was able to join me between shooting them when the show was in town last fall. Harvey picked Titanic, James Cameron's massive historical romance, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet as star-crossed lovers who find one another in the midst of one of history's greatest disasters. An epic, a phenomenon, a megalith, Titanic was all of those and more besides. A cultural moment that conquered the world in 1997 and 98, and probably as a direct result of its success, it's become shamefully underrated for both its dramatic and technical accomplishments. We're here to do something about that, and apparently pitch a sequel. This is Someone Else's Movie.
I was obsessed with the story of Titanic when I was little, just like read books, you know, when I was in third grade, and I did a report on it in fifth grade, and I was obsessed how this big, luxurious ship was doomed. Like, it was just like on its main voyage. I mean, the odds were like, what are the odds? And it's like, growing up in a Mexican household, like, it was like, how much of it was like, you know, destiny, or like, it was like, they were cursed, you know, there was a curse on the whole boat, and everyone suffered. Some, you know, because everyone was impacted. Even if you survived, you were somehow impacted with it.
Sure.
So I remember when the movie came out, I was like, obsessed with it. Like, I snuck into it because remember there was that nude scene, and I thought I was doing something so bad. I remember like watching it and then watching Kate Winslet's bare nipple, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not supposed to be watching this. And I just remember watching it, but thinking it was done so tasteful. It was tasteful nudity, you know. And yeah. I believe you are blushing, Mr. Big Artiste, was her famous line. And I just remember thinking, wow, it's so, James Cameron did such a great job of, you know, making this a love story, but it's such an action-packed film. And I loved it from beginning to end, and the special effects were beyond my wildest dreams at that point, you know, because
sure,
yeah. I was like, this is insane. Yeah, and I've always been, you know, just drawn to, like, older storylines. I don't know why, even as a child, I think I'm an old soul. I just feel like I definitely watched movies that I was not supposed to watch, like Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures was another one that I watched that I was not supposed to watch. And that one was too, too heavy. And I was just like, whoa, but I loved it. I was like, this is so cool. And based on true story, like, it was, you know, that blew my mind. So things that are based on true stories have always been my, like, you know, jam. I just love them so much. And Titanic, unfortunately, is the top one.
I mean, it is for a lot of people. It's. I don't know when it became a guilty pleasure. Maybe right after it was released and it was just embraced by teenage girls.
I think it was, it became such an international phenomenon that it became kind of cliche to like it. And it was weird because, like, that's a sign of a good movie. If it's the biggest grossing, well, not until recent, but, like, you know, at that point, it was the biggest thing in the world.
Yeah.
Literally, everyone knew it around the world. You knew Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On if it came on an elevator, you know, without any lyrics, because it probably couldn't get the copyrights. But, like, you know, you knew that song. And I sang that song at my eighth grade graduation. Like, I remember, like, the story of me being in love with Titanic has followed me all through my adolescence, and weirdly enough, still has stayed with me.
That's kind of lovely, though. I mean, it's, what is it, 22 years later. I see it. I run into it every now and then. I try not to watch it at home. It sounds dumb, but it's such a big screen experience.
Yeah,
it's
you have
massive
to.
Massive visual thing.
I watched it several times, I think, in the theaters, just because it was beautiful. Like, it was like that scene with a boat, and it's just like, and people are sliding. For a second, I was like, that looks cool. And at one point, I think there was rumors that there was going to be a theme park, like a water theme park. And a part of me was like, that's terrible, but also that's kind of great, because I always wanted to slide down.
I was going to say, everybody thinks they're going to be the one that makes it.
And I was like, but that's in poor taste. I have seen inflatable Titanics that are sinking at kids' parties, or like at a haunted maze thing. I saw one last year in Los Angeles, and I looked, I was like, is that Titanic, but it's sinking, and people go to the top of it and slide down like a slide. It's an inflatable Titanic. And I was like, I don't know. Maybe it still felt like it was like too soon. I was like, it was 1912 when it happened. But is it too soon? We're almost at 100 years, you know? Yeah. Well, we passed 100.
I think it's a hair too soon. Yeah. I think it's
it's that weird thing where, yeah, people come out of this effectively, it's a disaster movie, right? But they come out of it feeling so good that everyone's dead.
Yeah.
That finally, you know, because yes, it's ambiguous, but she dies. Like, that's the whole point. She's reunited with him on the staircase. Yeah. And all the people who were there are the people who didn't make it.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. Like, it works.
And the, you know, just a position of, like, just a life, well lived by someone who doesn't have the means to travel and, like, living the best life to the fullest. You know, growing up, like, you know, I didn't have money. I came from an immigrant family, low income. So watching both worlds in one scene was kind of really, I don't know, exhilarating to me, because it was just, like, the potential of living a great life, not necessarily because money is involved, but because you choose to live the best life, you know? Yeah.
And she embraces steerage and
yeah. And then when he says you're gonna go on and live and have grandbaby and all that scene, and I remember thinking to myself, I was like, he's so optimistic, and this guy is literally, I can see it. You're dying, you know what I mean? You're freezing, you're in the water, the odds aren't, you know, the odds look against you. And here you are, almost, you know, at your deathbed, and you're encouraging someone else to live their life, which to me was kind of like a moment where I'm going to do that. I'm going to find a way to live my best life. And for me, that was acting and performing. And, you know, I've been able to do it. So,
I honestly think that James Cameron would be really happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Like, he really does. Like, he wears his heart on his sleeve for all the engineering stuff, for all the tech. He traffics in these big, broad emotional beats and the archetypal characters. I mean, yeah, okay. Italian best friend is just, you know,
this stereotype.
There's got to be a better way to do Fabrizio. Right?
Yeah,
got to be a better way to do that now.
Yeah, because now that would not fly. The fact that he even flew then, like, it was like, it's me, Fabrizio. It was literally like saying, it's me, a racial stereotype, you know?
Yeah,
and I was like, you might as well just give him that line. And it was just, I think there's a better way of doing that, you know?
Yeah.
But aside from that, he was really great at, like, if you look at the movie, he sprinkled, like, you know, in Titanic, there were passengers from around the world. And he sprinkled them as the camera's, like, panning over through, like, the, you know, third class, you know, state rooms or whatnot. And you see, also you see, like, a Japanese man, you know, that, like, historically there's all these, like, stories of people who were on that boat. They were very accurate to, like, what he kept. And the old couple that goes back to the bedroom and decides to stay together, those were actual real people. Yeah. And so, like, they just, real stories that he found a way to incorporate to make it look seamless. It was like, oh, yeah, that was the person was walking in the corner of my eye, like, really briefly, you know?
Yeah.
But I was like, he did the research and it was really great. And also I was obsessed, so I was looking for any details that
I was going to say. So how was that? Because I know that he was, Cameron was absolutely, I mean, I know over the years of stories of how exacting he is. And he's the guy who, I've interviewed him a couple of times and I totally get where it all comes from. He's the guy who knows he can do your job better than you.
Right.
And he still has to rely on hundreds of people to make his movies. And I think on some level that really frustrates him. But I know that he was psychotically obsessed with getting the crests on the dishes right.
Yeah.
And you can never see it. He actually said so.
You can't see it. But it didn't matter. It was, he could see it.
He needed it to be there.
Yeah, exactly. And then those dishes fall at the end when the ship, you know, starting to tilt and whatnot. I love that stuff. I love details like that, even if it's just for the actors. Like, you know, working on sets where the set, the costumes mean a lot to, like, you know, bringing your character to life because it's the world you live in. And so I'm imagining, like, with Leo and Kate being in that boat and shooting in Rosarito, Mexico, is where they shot, and they build this whole
giant aqua tank.
Yeah, and to be there and to really, because you're not, you know, obviously on the ocean, you're literally on, you know, just a building set in Mexico, and you have to feel like you are, you know, leaving Cherbourg or you're leaving, you know, Southampton. And I think it helps that everything around you looks like it's 1912. The smells, the music, it all adds to it. It just changes everything. And so it makes it easier for the actor to fall into the character.
Yeah. And again, that's something about Titanic that people kind of blew past, is that the performances are really thoughtful and solid. The Romeo and Juliet of it, the aspect of it, of having this fictional character or this fictional couple running around the real life situation, and the genius of Cameron's, again, the engineering thing where he shows us, because he's got Paxton to provide all this exposition before the movie formally starts, but we get to see the wireframe model of how it's going to break down, and we realize about, I think it was my second time through, it's like, oh, they're always in the wrong place. they're exactly where things are about to go wrong.
Yeah.
So even if you weren't paying attention, even if you don't see it right there on the split screen, your brain knows. It's like, oh, don't be in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Like, please don't do that.
I mean, it's all for dramatic effect. Obviously, they have to be in this, you know, the storage room where they almost get caught. And that was one of the things that I remember seeing that wasn't accurate, that I'm surprised James let it slide. But flashlights weren't invented until 1913. And so when they have flashlights,
the big battery with a bulb on it.
Yeah, and so that was like, that was very ambiguous because it was like, that was ambitious because it was like a year too early.
State of the art on the Titanic.
Yeah.
Everything is the future.
So I think the only reason they probably decided, they could have, maybe they had so much money that they had the prototype, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. But I think that is, the 1913 was the year that flashlight. Yeah, so when I see that happen, because you have to, because those boys, you know, or the henchmen, I guess, or the security guards are like, snapping, and they see the handprint on the glass, and they have to use a flashlight. You know, it's so dark and they're mysterious, and they just got out of there in time. And then 2 seconds later, those guys are dead because it hits the iceberg in the water where they were 2 seconds before is gone. It's completely underwater, which only goes to show how many flight of stairs they had to go up within a couple of seconds before. You know, they keep missing death by seconds, and then eventually end up together. So, you know, what better love story than that?
Yeah, no, it's a great argument for romantic destiny. And I, you know, I got yelled at when I made this point in the 1997. It's like, it's the same story as Terminator. It really is. Like, it's one night.
If you break it down.
Everything is this perfect meeting of two people who are brought together by disaster and adversity. And, I mean, there's no time-traveling cyborg, although there might be. We don't see one, but that doesn't mean he's not there.
It's not
there. Like, the iceberg is the Terminator. I get it. Or the water. It's the liquid Terminator.
Yeah. He caused all this.
It's entirely possible. I kept waiting. You know, like, I was so hoping. And obviously, he wasn't going to do it because he was taking it seriously. But I was really hoping there'd be this one shot of Schwarzenegger as just like a steaming. A guy just shoveling coal in the bottom of the lower decks going, everything's fine. And that's all I want.
Just a little wink at the audience. Yeah,
yeah. Just made true lies. And
yeah,
They have a relationship.
Yeah.
No.
No.
It's all serious.
Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. So this is my alternate theory, which people hate. But structurally, like, it's ingenious. That's what I mean. Like, he understands how, when the movie is, what, 3 hours and 17 minutes long, he can still find ways to hold off on the action. Nothing happens for, like, technically plot-wise, nothing happens 100 minutes in that isn't just about Jack and Rose, but everything else, all these wheels are slowly turning and everything is moving towards it. And then when the iceberg hits, it all goes out the window and it just becomes about survival from moment to moment, which was so smart. And to not have an intermission too. It's like the roller coaster plunging you down.
I think at that point it was the longest movie I've ever seen, because I think I started watching Gone with the Wind when I was little and then I didn't finish it.
I probably can't really blame you.
Yeah, not that age. I saw it later and it was beautifully done and whatnot. But
if you're a child.
If you're a child, it's not for you. And the fact that it was like the longest movie I'd ever seen in theaters and I kept going back to it, just it spoke to, you know, how great it was. And I was just like, this is amazing. I was that weird kid at school just talking about it to my friends and they're like, when are you talking about? You know, because they're not into that. You know, they weren't watching Titanic. They were like, watching like the latest like Pokemon, you know, like movie. And I was like, Titanic is so good, you guys. I mean, think about it. And they were like, wow, you're weird, Harvey, you know. But I don't mind it because looking back, it was like such a great time.
That's kind of how I was with Star Wars. But with Star Wars, when you're 9, everybody can get behind it.
Everyone can behind it. Yeah, see, at least that's a good, you know, you find your people. Like, I feel like with Titanic, it was like I was talking to like middle-aged women about Titanic, and they were like, oh, you liked it? I love it. I was like, why did you watch that? What, you better close your eyes when that scene came on. And I was like, yeah, I closed my eyes when Kate Winslet is getting painted. You know, no. I was like,
it's
no.
Not, I mean, it's tender, which is why it
yeah, I've seen like murals with more description, you know, and like more, you know, in history books in school, you know, that that moment, such a brief, tender moment. So it's like, it was such a big deal, but it was great.
Even the sex scene is shot in such a way as to be kind of respectful.
Right.
And
tasteful.
Age appropriate.
Yeah, I think so. So I, because even at that age, I was like, if that's how it's done, then I guess it's beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, at that age, I was like, okay, I'm not traumatized by it, you know what I mean? I'm not watching, like, an adult film or something, you know? It's just like I'm watching, like, people who are genuinely in love, and it's like, that is the outcome of love, yeah.
Yeah, it's and of course, then you have the opposite version of that, which is whatever Billy Zane is doing, which I think is delightful. He's playing a character in a silent
movie. I think that's his best, like, work ever. Like, I really think he's really great. And I'd like to see more of Billy Zane. Like, you know, he's a talented actor.
Yeah, just, he's really fun.
Yeah.
He's sort of, I think, like, he had this tiny little window where the eccentricity was perfect for mm-hmm. everybody. Like, everybody got it. Dead Calm. I was going to say Dead Zane. That was mean. Mm-hmm. Dead Calm and the Tales from the Crypt movie he did. And he made this film called Blood and Concrete, where he's just sort of a kind of a criminal, kind of a hipster thief. In sort of 1991, and he's great. He's delightful. But then he decided to shave his head and just go for it.
Yeah, I don't know that when that transition happened, and that's the choice, and that's an actor's choice that he made. And
about 1994.
I
was there.
Yeah. For me, he's always going to be Cal, you know, Ockley, and like it's just he's so good at that, like his like voice inflection and his like, you know, diphthongs and his like speech pattern, like it's so perfect. Yeah. And it's just like you like Lamb, right, Sweet Pea? You know, like those moments over the dinner table with Kathy Bates and just great acting all around. Just like Kathy Bates, like, you know, it's just great. You're gonna cut her meat further, you know, to Cal, like that. Just Kathy Bates to me is perfection. And what a perfect Unsinkable Molly Brown. Like, they couldn't have cast that better. Like, I can't even think. If they did a remake now, I can't even think if anyone could do that role that I wouldn't want to go back to just Kathy Bates. Can she do it again?
Yeah. Frances McDormand. That's who I would like do this ridiculous overcast.
Well, that would be a very strong, like, I mean, a single Molly Brown, but like, I don't know, there's something like jolly about the way that Kathy played her.
Oh, no, she's great.
She's great. Because she gave you like the truth, but she did it in a way where it was like, well, I'm not being mean, you know, just like, oh, yeah, tell him he's being like, you know, chauvinist, you know, pig. And
Well, she and Zane are basically allowing the audience to have fun with it, to say that, you know, like, we're probably gonna die, it doesn't matter. Brown's gonna live.
And then she has her tender moment too when she's in the boat and she's like, what's the matter with you, you know, those are your men out there. And it's so I remember watching that and I was just like, oh, she's really trying. And to show where, like, the level, even doesn't matter that you had money, but because she was a woman, you know, and she stood up on a boat and the man who just, you know, part of the crew is like, and there'll be one less in this Bellevue shot that all in your face, you know? And that the fact that one man was telling all these women on the boat what to do and wouldn't go back to help the people who need help because it's one man's decision. You know what I mean? Yeah. And the fact that even Unsinkable Molly Brown spoke up and even she was outnumbered because she didn't have the support of the, you know, the rest of the boat with her. They were all like, you know, living by the rules that these men were making. So it's kind of very much like the time, you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what Rose is doing too. Like, she's just by refusing to hang around with Cal and her mother, to just go with Jack and learn things, be someone else, and just, you know, dance in steerage and do all that stuff. That's what I love about Winslet's performance, is that you watch her come to life. You see her light up. DiCaprio has less to do as an actor. Like, he's there to convince her to come and play with him.
Right.
Basically.
Right.
And the love stuff is between that sort of a duet. But in that first hour, Winslet has so much going on that she doesn't show us. And then it all just kind of comes spilling out.
Yeah.
And I'd seen Heavenly Creatures. I knew who she was.
And I didn't see Heavenly Creatures until after, because I wanted to know who this actress was.
Oh, sure, right. That would make sense.
And I was like, who is she? Because I was smitten. Like, I was just like, she did an amazing job. I was like, who is this actress? And anything that she would do, I would want to watch. Like, anything. Like, I was obsessed. I was just like, oh my God, can't wait. Like, so I haven't met her to this day, but if I did, I'd be like, I would probably be weirded out.
We technically had dinner together. We were both at a thing.
Once, okay.
And she was, we were sort of at tables facing away from each other, but it's one of those people who you know where she is in the room at every given moment.
Like,
she's either because people are flocking to her, and this would have been, it was for Little Children,
Oh, I love that film too.
Tom Prada novel and Todd Field film. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was there was a party at the film festival, and they invited all the film critics because they were basically just trying to make us love the movie, but we already did, so it was
easy. It's a great film.
And when she came in, she was by herself. She wasn't escorted. But like, you just felt this animal thing of everybody going, like all the heads turned.
Star power.
Yeah, really is something. And
that
everybody else
is
there too. No one, like, poor Patrick Wilson. I like him too. But yeah.
But see, that's what I mean. There's just that aura of her, you know, that I think is so great. And it really translates into the film with one of the best introductions for a character is, you know, Rose's introduction with the hat
and the way he shot.
Yeah, and it's just completely raised up. And that in the music, in the score that he created for her, just that like crescendo into like a, you know, over a bird's eye view coming down, and It was incredible. Like, that's what filmmaking to me is, like, yeah. just done to perfection. Like, it was like, you thought of everything. You thought of every second was accounted for. It wasn't a mistake that the music was aligned. It was, like, everything is just perfect.
Yeah. He really, I mean, he built it, obviously, from the ground up, right? But the cost of it, the scale of it.
Yeah.
Something that we really hadn't seen for a while. I mean, I think the year before there was The English Patient, which mm-hmm. is an epic, but an epic produced on a budget.
Yeah.
It's very clearly working with specific constraints and even to the fact that they pared down the book and took out all this other stuff. And that was the right call because it makes the movie a straight line instead of a sort of Jeremy Bearme thing.
Right. And then that's the time where, like, studios aren't doing the, you know, they're not doing Cleopatra where, like, everyone's on location and then building sets and leaving those sets that, weirdly enough, feel like they've become part of history, you know, in those location that they shot at. But this was, like, something that it was either going to pay off or it was going to be a flop, you know? And kudos to everyone who just, you know, supported it and gave it whatever extra money that it needed to be done, because I can't imagine if it wasn't done to its fullest potential, then maybe we wouldn't be as obsessed with it as I am.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I think so. I think so. I think it comes down to, yeah, I mean, it's always Cameron's vision, right?
Because
that was the other thing that fascinates me about him. Up until, maybe even still, because I don't know how much the Avatar sequels are going to cost, but they won't be cheap.
Right.
But between...
But they've proven themselves at the box office.
Yeah, I think everything's profit at this point.
Yeah.
but between, I want to say The Abyss. So The Abyss, Terminator 2, True Lies, Titanic, and Avatar have all been the most expensive movie ever made. Like, every time he makes a movie, it is the most expensive movie ever produced, because he's building the technology and he's just also doing, he's confident enough that the money will be there. He just keeps going. And I always forget this happened. I ran into him. He was here doing press for Titanic. And it was whatever week Alien Resurrection opened. So the week before or 2 weeks before.
Mm.
And he was at that screening. Because my tick is that I just don't leave a movie. Now, of course, everybody stays to see if Nick Fury shows up and invites the Transformers to join the Avengers. But at the time, it's like, I would just watch the credits. I like credits. And he was the only other person still watching the credits. Like, the lights come up at the very end, and it's him in the it's this old, beautiful old theater of the York that had a balcony. And I was up in the balcony, and he was down in the orchestra. And the lights come up, and he's tall, so he stands up, and it's just like, oh, that's James Cameron at an Alien movie. Hang on. So I just had to. I mean, we're both leaving together.
Yeah.
And I just kind of walked up and went, I don't want to be rude, but, you know, what did you think? And he's like, it's not the movie I would have made. And then I realized, like, later, he's 2 weeks away from opening Titanic, maybe even only 1 week away. I have no idea what day it was. I should look this up. But he was so relaxed, and he wasn't panicking or worried. The film was done.
The work was done.
But also, he wasn't sweating it, which is like this gargantuan monster thing where, for the first time, really, he's put his entire heart out, and he's just, you know what, I'll go see an Alien movie. And the fact that he could just come up with a flippant response, like he wasn't panicking or shocked to be recognized.
Yeah.
Nothing like that. It was just this, he was so calm. It was eerie. I've interviewed him a couple of times since, and it turns out he's just always pretty calm.
Yeah.
But
I would imagine you have to be after, I mean, it's like, that's the, you know, the smallest of the things he has to worry about, I guess, at any given moment. Yeah. It's just like, I mean, if the film is like something that you're focusing on with the budget and building sets and sound, then just having like a real conversation about the project is probably like the, you know, cherry on top. They're just like, this is the easy part, you know?
True. The only time I ever see him is when the work is done.
Yeah, and so we don't see that, you know, the master at work behind closed doors, if you will. So
stuff they don't talk about, the stuff they refuse to talk about in the documentaries.
Right, because then it would make it seem like, well, why are you doing this to yourself? You know, why are you killing yourself by making this?
Yeah.
But then it's also because it gives, you know, the rest of the world that piece of art that will live forever, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool to think about it, because here we are talking about that film, you know, that he worked on for a couple of years, and it is still, it's part of our, you know, just history. Like, it's so cool.
Tied for the most Oscars ever. It's like, not only did it make people happy and make all the money in the world, it's like, it's a full on across the board success. I mean, I remember when he accepted the Oscar and he said, I deserve this, let's party. And it's just like, after the moment of silence, that came kind of weird. But I think that's part of it too, right? Like, he's so far into the thing that it becomes abstracted that it isn't really about.
Well, I think he doesn't look for validation, and it comes to the point where it's like, it could be a borderline of like, it's not being cocky, but it's also like, he knows he does really damn, you know, good work, and he knows that he yeah, he got the Oscar because he probably would say if he didn't get the Oscar that he was cheated. You know what I mean? Because yeah. he does the work. And I think everybody who puts their heart and soul into something thinks that's their baby, you know? So their baby's the best baby and, you know, in the nursery. And when it doesn't get picked for prettiest baby, that's when the problems start, you know?
Yeah,
but I'm glad that everyone's, you know, procreating the most beautiful babies they can.
I was wondering where you're going to take
yeah. that. And they put the work into it, you know what I mean?
Like, and dude, so, your baby broke in half and killed 1,300 people and there's an iceberg stuck in it. It's like,
yeah, but it's the most beautiful baby. It's my baby. You know, no one talks bad about my baby. Yeah, so I love that film so much. And I think about all the characters. People have tried to make, like, Titanic, like,
sure.
not, like, spinoffs or anything, but, like, their own version. It's never right, you know? It's just, like, they don't have the budget, so you could just tell the costumes are just not as high-end or the music, or it's cheesy, or the storyline. And I feel like if they redid Titanic, I would want to be, like, playing multiple characters in the background, just like Miss Trudy, who like comes in for tea and like helps when Rose gets in an argument with Cal and like, you know, in the veranda and like picks up the tea. He's like, I got it, miss, you know, and it's me dressed as Miss Trudy. And then, of course, when she's sliding down the thing, I feel bad for Miss Trudy. I feel really bad because, you know, Rose's mom sends her back to the room to turn on the heaters because this is all ridiculous. The ship's not going down. It's the unsinkable ship. And then you know, as the audience, she's going to die. You know, she's going back into the room. The ship's going down, you know. And no one ever goes out and tries to get Trudy until it's too late. And someone's like, hold on, Miss Trudy. And she's holding on to the edge. And then she slides down, you know, the whole outside of the ship. I always felt bad for her.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's, again, the wealth. That's part of the cynicism of the age, right? The wealthy survive in luxury. Cal steals a baby.
I'm all she's got. Yeah.
Yeah, which is, again, total dick move, but yeah. absolutely something Donald
survival
Trump
mechanism. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. If they recast that role, it'd probably be like Donald
Eric.
Trump.
It's Eric Trump. It's not even one of the good Trumps.
Yeah, if it would, yeah, and you wouldn't have to tell them to act. They just say these lines, you know, yeah. and they'd be like, oh, and it would just sound.
Take the baby. Which one? Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Just yeah, you just say the lines. It'll sound perfect and evil, so yeah. it'll be perfect. Yeah.
So who would you? I mean, if you do recast it, who would you put in the leads? Who is capable of playing those roles now?
That is
Gosling and McAdams are a little too old.
I would say, if this would have been done,
Gosling Stone are still. Emma Stone could wear the hat.
Emma Stone look great in the hat. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Rose is 16 at that.
Yeah, you need
age.
It to be,
you need to be young, and yeah, so we would need someone who can play 16 but has the chops. You know, so I don't know if we have a 16-year-old actress who could maybe. Yeah. Maybe 22, like playing 16, but like
who's, yeah, and
but I can't think of that actress. I'm like, yo, that's great. I mean, I'm trying to, but.
Oh, no, worry about it. There's a long,
long
way to go there.
Who would you?
I don't know. I think it would have to be an unknown. I think you would have to make
you have
an
to discover
even bigger
someone.
Risk.
Yeah.
Somebody who hasn't already, you know, like co-starred with Emma Thompson in an Ang Lee adaptation of Jane Austen.
Right.
Some total new face.
Yeah.
And you have to trust that it works.
Right.
And for
but
Jack,
I do like that idea of Rachel back, like if this was like maybe 15 years back or 10 years back, like right after... You know, maybe 10 years. Like, yeah, I would see Rachel McAdams still playing that role. She would do great.
She would be great.
She'd be great. Yeah. Local Canadian.
That's true, yeah. Just that we have a good talent pool here.
You guys have a great talent pool.
But I don't know who.
What about Chad? Oh, man. There's so many, like, just teeny bop heartthrobs that I wouldn't want to, like, give it to someone who can just look the part and maybe carry the role. I think Leo really did dive in, although he does a great job in What's Eating Gilbert Grape. I think that's some of his, you know, top work there. But and that was younger than Titanic, so he was already proving his chops. I think I heard a story that, like...
It's Romeo and Juliet, too,
yeah,
right?
See, so he was picking his... He was really selective, and I appreciate that, because I think I heard that at one point he was offered Hocus Pocus, which was a kids' film.
Yeah.
And it was between that and I think it's What's Eating Gilbert Grape. Like, what? It was that film or something. And then I think someone was advising him to, like, do, because it's like a Disney film and that's your genre. You're like your teenage followers and whatnot. But he saw the bigger picture. And I think that's the story that I heard. And I was like, always like, wow, that's kind of really cool. Because it's easy sometimes to take the role that is popular, you know, and be like, well, this is, everyone's going to see that. And this is more like drama and it'll be like very niche, you know. And it's like, I would always go for the challenge. It doesn't matter what the eyes are going to be watching, just as long as you're comfortable and doing the best work forward and presenting that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and he'd already done This Boy's Life by that point too, mm-hmm. when he would have had that choice. And that's a fearless performance mm-hmm. opposite, like maybe the last great De Niro performance.
Yeah.
And you see that. I mean, I remember watching that film and coming out of the theater and going, oh, okay, he's a movie star. Like that kid I've never seen in anything before is never going away.
Yeah.
He's amazing and he's got range. And then he's kind of, and he kept on delivering on that. And then, you know, like 10 years, he sort of, between maybe, let's say, Blood Diamond and The Revenant, where he was sort of aggressively chasing awards performances and how much stress can he put himself through. And then since The Revenant, I think he's become a more interesting actor again. Like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I have issues with the film, but he's not one of them. He's
great.
He's terrific and he's relaxed.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something, but you're right, after The Revenant, like something happened where like it was like a check mark that was like, of course, you know, actors worked their whole life, and it's great if you do get accolade after, you know, a certain project. So I think that was one of those moments where, like, it was a check mark, and I was like, now you can got what you want, you know, and now you can, you know, drop your guard, enjoy, and just do fun and have fun with the characters, and which he was before. But I'm saying that, like, you know, as an actor, I can see why it's like a career, like, you know, strategy and whatnot.
Sure.
But I think you're right. After that, it was kind of like, I like him and the stuff he does. It seems like he's just really falling into the characters easily.
Yeah. I mean, even the reunion he did with Winslet in Revolutionary Road,
mm-hmm.
it's fine.
Yeah.
I just don't, you know, Michael Shannon's the most interesting thing in that movie. He's only in it for three scenes.
I just like them together, Kate and him. I don't know.
It is. Like, people clearly respond. They're very much somewhere together, and the whole world goes, aw.
Yeah. It's something about a nostalgia or the fact that maybe subconsciously we want them to be together.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it's
we want
the love they never got to live.
Right. Right? Like, so I wouldn't be surprised if we all just like are like complete awe that in like a couple of years they end up together for some reason. and that's going to be the biggest like love story inside of a love story, outside of a love story film. You know, like it's going to be this huge thing where like someone has to write a story about that. And then like it's going to be that we met on the set of Titanic.
That's a really good, interesting angle for a story.
Yeah.
Just some fictional version of that.
Yeah. That'd be cool, right?
Because what is it like to be that famous and that bonded by an experience that was potentially like traumatic.
And also I feel like the time was never right for them. Like they could have been together. And I just feel like something is like, you know, Kate was married and different relations.
DiCaprio won't date anyone over 26. That might be the issue.
I don't know. I feel like at the end of the day, like if you love someone, like it might find its way back. Like it's like, I don't know. I'm still a romantic at heart with
them.
You're
holding it out.
I'm holding out for them. And I'm just thinking that they're going to be like 50 and like they're going to be like on a cruise somewhere. And they're going to be like, remember when we shot that movie? And it's like, let's do it. Let's just get married. We belong together, you know.
And then the boat sinks. This is a horrible future you've given them.
Okay, I never said the boat sank.
I said cruise.
But never said like the boat sank. Like,
I mean, it has to now.
No, it doesn't. It's like this boat makes it to the dock. They get off and they get married, and we all hear about it, and we all cheer and celebrate in the streets.
See, I picture it happening. The reconnecting is over. I don't know why, but I have this ridiculous Florence Nightingale setup where he tries to do something extreme for a role, like eat another bear's liver, and he gets food poisoning, and she's right there and can help him.
Oh, God.
And I don't know why. It's like, maybe it's The English Patient. It's another kind of thing where they recover.
I thought you were going to go and like be tragic and say they were on that cruise ship, and then as soon as they admit their love to each other, the cruise ship goes down or something, and no one survives. And it's like, no, that would be the biggest tragedy.
That would be fascinating. What if you tell that story from the perspective of just like an engineer or a food server on the boat who just gets to witness all of this?
Yeah.
That's where you have the ingenue.
Right.
Taken under somebody's wing, and then they watch this, and then tragedy strikes.
Yeah.
And the ingenue saves, but the ingenue can only save one.
I guess that could be the chef because the chef survived. Because he was so intoxicated in real life.
That was
a real story. Mm-hmm. From Titanic, the actual chef knew the boat was going down and was like, well, it's going down. So started drinking really, and like within 2 hours, drank so much alcohol that his body temperature was just heated to
antifreeze.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And so he was in the water and survived. And so then the chef is there, remember, where like they're walking out and they're at the edge and the boat's already like kind of perfectly like bobbing like a corkscrew. Mm-hmm. And she looks over to her left and she sees the chef. The chef is on the side of the boat already. He's on the edge too.
Yes.
And then they go under. And then so James was really smart about putting that in there because he did survive. Like, he just thought it was going to go down, so he just got wasted. He was like, well, we're all going down. We might as well enjoy it. So kept drinking and drinking, and then he survived. And he given up. He threw in the towel and said, we're all going to die. I'm just going to drink myself to death, and survived.
See, that's the story I want for the sequel.
That's the story.
Someone trying it.
That's what I should do. I should pitch that. I should play the chef.
You can play the chef.
Yeah, and then everything through my eyes, my intoxicated eyes.
I think that could be really great. It's increasingly, and you know, the best kind of drunk performance is the one where someone is struggling to keep it together.
Right.
But if this guy has already decided that his life is over, he's gonna have the best time.
And also, it's his perception. So, what does that look like through, you know?
Bleary
alcohol poisoning. Yeah. Like, things are not what they seem. And do I start talking to a giant rabbit, you know? And it's just like, but it's not the lady with the hat. And like, there's just all these elements that could happen with that.
I want to see this now.
Yeah.
Like, there's got
to
be a way.
We're pitching this. We're going straight to Fox.
Fox and Disney. They'll take it.
Yeah.
They own it all now.
It'll be on Disney Plus next year.
What would you even call it? Titanic 2, T-O-O.
Yeah. S-S-R-M. Titanic 2, SS.
RMS Drinky Ship.
RMS Drinkies.
I would actually watch the show.
RMS, it's just a hiccup.
That's right, they can't call the Carpathia because they can't
yeah.
get to the radio room.
You just can't really function and do it.
Oh, of course, because it's Morse.
Yeah. So his SOS, yeah. And that's all they're saying is like, good night, shut down your systems.
It says DNR? Does that mean we should leave them alone?
Yeah. That's another horrible side of the story, that there was a boat a few miles away that could literally see the lights of Titanic. And because of all the first class passengers trying to send messages back home that they were arriving early, it overpowered the system. Or not overpowered, but it was so annoying to just hear their messages and they just turned off the machine.
Yeah.
And so the idea that I was like, don't turn off your machine. If it's annoying, then just, you know what I mean? But like, don't turn it off. Like, so many people could have survived. But then again, then we wouldn't have a movie, so.
Yeah. Well. Historical tragedy does lead to contemporary entertainment all the time.
All the time. Chicago. And,
right. Also shot in Toronto, so there.
Yeah.
And Cameron said he thought about including the Carpathia, but it would be too distracting.
At that point you're going, the story's going so well that if you throw in another fact like that, like it was just, why did we need to, you know, yes, it adds another layer, but the movie's already so long.
Yeah, and he wanted us to feel hopeless with Rose at that point, like to have her, because blowing the whistle, you don't want to be thinking about, oh, the boat will hear it.
Yeah.
You want it to be empty.
No hope. And just that, and have that with her. That's smart. See? Genius at work.
Yeah, he knows how to do this
stuff. He knows what he's doing.
Just breaking the whistle out of the ice and that whole struggle to rally herself. Again, it's amazing to me that she didn't win. Like, the actors did win Oscars for this. And I know there are other things happening in the world, and As Good As It Gets was embraced for being the more realistic thing, although in the rearview mirror, not so much.
Not so much.
But it is, like, there is a specific type of performance that you need to give to be that transparent in a movie this big and to still feel like you're a character rather than a stock character or a puppet. And DiCaprio's good, but Winslet is great.
I think Winslet should have won. I honestly do. I think the movie got so hyped that it became so commercial in a way that people were kind of, you know, well, that's not really art, is it?
Yeah, you know, it can't be that good.
It can't be that good. If everyone loves it, something's wrong, you know? And it's like, no, maybe it's that good. Maybe this is as good as it gets.
Yeah. I mean, here obviously in Toronto, the big story was that we had two Canadian nominees for Best Director, and Adam McGoyan was up for The Sweet Hereafter. And the Toronto Film Critics Association, I think it was our first year, gave him the prize, our Best Picture Award. And I liked The Sweet Hereafter, but I voted for Titanic, and I'm proud of this. And I was kind of mocked a little bit, I don't mind saying, for my enthusiasm. It's like, no, it's just a great movie. Like, it's a beautifully engineered piece of commerce. It is absolutely a commercial film, but it's also art. And it is so, like, if the ending didn't land, if somehow, and we haven't even mentioned Gloria Stewart, if that stuff wasn't there to connect, she's got three chunks of film to stitch those performances together with Winslet's and the two of them. And then, you know, like, they're both nominated for the same character, which almost never happens and never has happened in the same year. And it's just, it's this gentle little poetry that puts all the big stuff into focus, right? Like, we get to see the legacy of Titanic in this woman, in this fictional character, But we also have the entire legacy of Hollywood because she was an ingenue and a star in the olden days. Mm-hmm. And this continuity that it creates. And again, he's a genius to come up with that structure and have Paxton there to sort of be her audience and take it all in. She's as much an exposition machine as he is mm-hmm. in those scenes. But just the way he puts it up, like Paxton just puts it all aside and just listens. You don't have to do that in these movies. And he chose to get that.
Yeah. It's such a good film.
I moved again.
I'm going to go back and watch it in the big theater, please.
Yeah. When was the last time you saw it?
I think I saw it for the anniversary. I was playing Limited in theaters in L.A., and I went to see it. I think I saw it by myself because I was trying to be nostalgic, and that's kind of what I did when I was little. I snuck into the theater by myself, and which was weird that no one thought child sneaking in and watching Titanic by themselves. I guess that's one of the films that they weren't looking out for kids to try to sneak into. They were like more like the Halloween or the I Know What You Did Last Summer or Scream, and they're looking for kids to like. They, I walk right past that and went straight to the Titanic. They're like, oh, that one? Okay.
He must be accompanied by
It's like his parents must be inside. They dragged that poor kid into watching that film, which I played really well. I was like, yes, that's exactly what it is. No. But that was the last time. I have the limited edition with the collection of behind the scenes and all that. And it's always fun to like, I love behind the scenes stuff. I love when actors talk about the process or when you see clips of them in the giant water tank and Kate making fun of like, you know, it's like you're walking around and it's like, it's cold water. And then all of a sudden it's warm water, you know, and it's like trying to get away from it. And just stuff like that where just like, those moments will live forever with them as a performer, but they'll also be shared with us through like limited, you know, features. Yeah. It's so great to watch.
Yeah, no, special editions are great for that stuff. I think the last time I saw it, the last time I saw it, it was in 3D. Have you seen that version?
No.
It was, I want to say 15 years later, and it was mostly just Cameron doing it because he could. Mm. It's like, look, I can do a 3D conversion that actually works because I know he's seen a few that he doesn't like.
Yeah.
And so he obviously solved the problem for himself and figured out a way to do it. And it actually works. Mm. It works for everything. It's a good spatialization, I guess is the word, but they separate the images and it makes it work as a proper 3D experience, even in scenes where people are just sitting still and in a room. Mm. But what really worked for me, surprisingly, wasn't the height of the boat disaster part, but the absolute isolation in the water. In the end, you're just in this deep black and it goes on forever. And it landed in a way, I mean, I'd seen the film maybe 3 or 4 times already theatrically by then, and it landed in a way that really hit me. It's like, oh, this is what he wanted.
Different feeling.
Yeah.
This
absolute hopelessness.
Yeah.
And the individual pieces of ice are floating and you can tell how far away they all are. And it really worked. And again, he spent...
Did they make the theater colder at that moment?
No, that would have been...
That would have really, really...
Crank the air conditioning.
Yeah,
in the last hour.
That would have been smart. Yeah. Somebody must have. By hour 3, it was just freezing in that theater.
Yeah.
That's the way it should have... Okay.
We should get them to do that.
Here we go. Yeah. We're pitching a new idea.
Yeah. We'll do that for the sequel.
Okay.
We'll do that for the 2.
Yeah.
As RMS Drinky.
I'm Drinky.
But yeah, there's an IMAX version now, which is properly formatted. They did the DMR process. It's at Cinesphere every now and then. I'm assuming you're going to catch that if you can.
Yeah.
But it's still like it's not the same at home. I know TVs are bigger now, but
and I think the only thing I saw at home is the special features because that's stuff you can watch and it's a fun little like snippet. I don't want to watch the whole film probably at home because
it's a different kind of commitment. You don't want your phone ringing in the middle of it.
Three and a half hours. It's a lot of time. Yeah,
a sensory deprivation tank and a screen the size.
Yeah,
of I'll do that. That'll
yeah.
Work. So. This is kind of, I think we kind of maybe already covered it, but the final question on the podcast is always the same, which is there anything from Titanic that you have used yourself or borrowed or incorporated or outright stolen and just used for your own work?
Yeah, I think I would say, like I said, I really like the performances of all the actors, especially the characters like Molly Brown and by Kathy Bates and, you know, and also Cal. Just the character work and development of doing work. I play character parts a lot and to be true to them and to, you know, even if it's a comedy, it has to be grounded and it has to be real. So when it's funny, it's organically funny and it's not shoved down, you know, your throat. And so I remember watching that movie at a young age and knowing that I wanted to be an actor. And then as I got older, using it as a reference a lot just because I wanted to. The work is so brilliant. I take every character I do, whatever it is, comedy or drama, and really get to the core of the character. And I think for me, looking at how great those performances were, reminds me of like what really great work and character work can look like.
Yeah, I would just encourage people who haven't seen it in a while to go take another look at it.
Yeah.
It, not only does it hold up, it's really good.
It's a good history lesson, too. A lot of the facts are in there.
Yeah.
You like history, too.
The thing I have held back for this entire episode is that my wife, Kate, is a massive, also Titanic fan, and now I don't know if she knows the story about the chef. She must.
She must.
She's going to kick me for even suggesting she doesn't. But it's like, I'd never heard that. And she was, the last time Titanic was around, I don't think we've ever seen it together, but the last time the 3D release came out, she was kind of diving back in. There's a book of recipes from the menus. The
oh, right.
Menus.
We have
a tea towel.
I have a copy of the second class dinner menu, which is like really cool. And like just it's this package I got when I went to Belfast because the ship was built in Belfast. So they have this museum for Titanic. So I had to go. And they have all this memorabilia, like, replicas of like everything. The actual soap that they used in first class, the company's still around. Huh. And they make little squares the way that they would have packaged them for the first class passengers. And so you have that, and you have the actual posters that they were around town to buy your tickets, how much was tickets, the menus, like all that, like really cool little things and trinkets. And I have those all on display in my bathroom.
Aw.
Yeah.
It's a shrine.
It's a little shrine. It's like, well, my whole bathroom is like aquatic. So it's like seashells and Titanic memorabilia.
You're kind of asking for trouble.
Yeah.
I'm worried about it.
I don't know.
Flooding.
Well,
guess it's only gonna
you're owning that bathroom.
Yeah, that's fair. You've isolated. You've contained
it. As long as you're not in there, you're fine. But yeah, so it's a great movie. Still holds up.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you picked it. I was kind of hoping someone would someday.
Oh, really? I'm the first one? That makes
sense.
Yeah.
No,
wow.
We've done Aliens. I think that's the only other Cameron film that's come up. But I'm really glad you picked Titanic.
Yeah. And I was torn because I think subconsciously I was like, well, everyone's going to think it's such a cliche to pick that movie because like I really like it. And I have no shame in like saying that I like it, you know? So
there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. If you like something, it's
for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It connects.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
My thanks to Harvey Guillen, who returns as Guillermo in the second season of What We Do in the Shadows this Wednesday, April 15th at 9 p.m. on FX. And again at 9:30. There's two episodes. Don't miss them. And you'll see him in the Quibi series Don't Look Deeper, which I understand is coming soon. Thanks also to Corinne Delage. She knows what she did. You can find Harvey on Twitter at Harvey Guillen, all one word. And you can find Titanic on Blu-ray and DVD from Paramount Home Entertainment. It's also streaming on Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Hollywood Suite in Canada, and available for rental and purchase on iTunes and Google Play pretty much everywhere. And yes, I asked. Kate did know the story about the chef. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where in addition to my film duties, I'm hosting a new podcast called Now What?, interviewing Torontonians about our weird new normal of self-isolation in the age of a pandemic. You can find it Tuesdays and Fridays in your podcatcher of choice, and you can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or you're enjoying the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. Jordan Heath Rowling's The Big Story is absolutely essential listening right now. Thanks for your support, and thanks for sticking around. Stay inside, watch movies. I'll see you next week.